How clean her skin looks. She's like a westerly breeze at sunrise, rare and fresh, and good to get into your lungs and your heart.
When do you next leave for Lisbon?
She asked. By the afternoon tide on Friday.
I have been to Falmouth 3 times, she told him. A fine harbour.
The finest north of the equator. A far-sighted government would convert it to its proper use as a great naval base and depot. Everything is in its favour. We shall need such a harbour yet.
For what? Asked Verity, watching his face. Aren't we at peace?
For a little while. A year or two, maybe. But there will be trouble with France again. Nothing is properly settled. And when war comes, sea power will decide it.
Ruth, said Mrs. Teague in the other room, I see Faith is sitting out this dance. Why do you not go and keep her company? Very well, Mama.
The girl rose obediently.
What sort of rumours do you mean?
Asked her mother when she was out of earshot. Lady Whitworth raised her pencilled eyebrows.
About whom? Captain Blamey.
About Captain Blamey? Dear me, I don't think it kind to lend too much credence to whispered stories, do you?
No, no, certainly not. I make a point of paying no attention to them myself.
Mind you, I heard this on good authority, otherwise I should not consider repeating it even to you. Lady Whitworth raised her fan, which was of chicken-skin parchment, delicately painted with cherubs. Behind this screen, she began to speak in an undertone into Mrs. Teague's pearl earring. Mrs. Teague's black button eyes grew smaller and rounded as the tale proceeded. The creases in her eyelids moved down like little Venetian blinds, which had come askew.
No! She exclaimed. Is that so? Why, in that case, he should not be allowed in the room. I shall consider it my duty to warn Verity.
If you do so, my dear, pray leave it until another occasion. I have no wish to be drawn into the quarrel that might ensue. Besides, my dear, perhaps she already knows. You know what girls are these days, man mad. And, after all, she is 25. The same as your eldest, my dear. She won't get many more chances. On her way to join her sister, Ruth was intercepted by Ross. It was to ask her for the dance which was about to begin. A gavotte. That variation on the minuet, which was now rivaling the minuet in favour. He found this time that she smiled more easily, with less constraint. From being slightly scared by his attentions, it had not taken her long to become flattered. A girl with 4 unmarried sisters does not come to her first ball with overweening expectations. To find herself singled out by a man of some distinction was heady wine, and Ross should have been careful with his doses. But he, in a good-natured way, was only pleased to find pleasure in making someone's evening a success. Rather to his own surprise, he found he was enjoying the dance. There was a pleasure in mixing with people, although he tried to despise it. As they separated and came together again, he continued without break his whispered conversation with her, and she giggled abruptly, earning a glance of reproof from her second sister, who was in the next square and dancing with 2 elderly men and a titled lady. In the refreshment room, Captain Blamey had produced a sketch.
Now you see, this is the foremast, mainmast and mizzenmast. On the foremast is the mainsail, the...
Did you draw that? Verity asked.
Yes. It is a sketch of my father's ship. She was a ship of the line. He died 6 years back. If...
It's uncommonly well drawn.
Oh, that... One gets used to the pencil. You see, the foremast and the mainmast are square-rigged. That is to say, they carry yards at... across the run of the ship. The mizzenmast is part square-rigged, but she carries a gaff and a spanker boom, and the sail is called the spanker. It was called a lateen in the olden days. Now this is the bowsprit. It is not shown in this sketch, but a spritsail is set beneath it, so... Miss Verity, when can I see you again after tonight?
Their heads were close together, and she glanced up briefly into his intent brown eyes.
That I couldn't say, Captain Blamey.
It is all I plan for.
Oh, said Verity.
On the foremast, this is the mainsail. Then comes the lower topsail, and then the upper topsail. This attachment to the bowsprit is called the jackstaff, and...
What is the jackstaff for?
Verity asked, short of breath.
It is the, Dare I hope that... If I could hope that my interest was in the smallest way returned. If that were possible.
I think that is possible, Captain Blamey.
He touched her fingers for a moment.
Miss Verity, you give me a hope, a prospect which would inspire any man. I feel... But before I see your father, I must tell you something that only your encouragement would give me strength to venture.
5 people entered the refreshment room, and Verity hastily straightened up, for she saw it was the Warleggans, with Francis and Elizabeth. Elizabeth saw her at once, and smiled and waved and came across. She was wearing a dress of peach-coloured muslin, with a white crepe turban close-fitting about her head.
"We'd no intention of coming, my dear," she said, in amusement at Verity's surprise. "How pretty you're looking. How do you do, Captain Blamey?"
"Your servant, ma'am."
"It was really George's fault,"
Elizabeth went on, excited, and therefore radiantly beautiful.
"We were supping with him, and I believe he found our entertainment difficult."
"Cruel words from kind lips," said George Warleggan. "The fault is with your husband for wishing to dance this barbarous écossaise."
Francis came across to them. His face was flush with drink, and the effect also with him was a heightening of his good looks.
"We've missed nothing that matters," he said. "All the fun's to come. I could not be sedate tonight if all England depended on it."
"Nor I,"
said Elizabeth. She smiled at Captain Blamey.
"I hope our boisterous spirits don't jar on you, sir."
The sailor took a deep breath.
"Not in the very least, ma'am. I have every reason to be happy myself."
In the ballroom, Ruth Teague had returned and Lady Whitworth had gone.
"So Captain Poldark has left you at last, child," said Mrs. Teague. "What explanation did he offer you for such conduct?"
"None, mamma,"
said Ruth, fanning herself brightly.
"Well, it is gratifying to be distinguished by such a genteel man, but there is reason in all things. You should know your manners if he does not. People are talking already."
"Are they? Oh, dear, I cannot refuse to dance with him. He is most polite and agreeable."
"No doubt, no doubt. But it is not becoming to make oneself too cheap. And you should think also of your sisters."
"He asked me for the next dance after this."
"What? And what did you say?"
"I promised it for him."
"Off!"
Mrs. Teague shuddered fastidiously. But she was not as displeased as she sounded.
"Well, a promise is a promise. You may dance it now. But you must not go into supper with him, and leave Joan to her own devices."
"He's not asked me."
"You're very free with your answers, child. I think his attentions must have gone to your head. Perhaps I shall have a word with him after supper."
"No, no, mamma, you mustn't do that."
"Well, we shall see,"
said Mrs. Teague, who really hadn't the slightest intention of discouraging an eligible man. Hers was a token protest, to satisfy her sense of what was right and proper, of how she would behave if she had only one daughter, and that one with a fortune of £10,000. With five on the books and no dowry for any of them, it deprived one of scope. But they need not have concerned themselves. By the time the supper interval came, Ross had unaccountably disappeared. In his last dance with Ruth, he had been stiff and preoccupied, and she wondered furiously whether in some manner her mother's criticisms had reached his ears. As soon as the dance was over, he left the ballroom and walked out into the mild, cloudy night. At the unexpected sight of Elizabeth, his make-believe enjoyment had crumbled away. He wished more than anything to get out of her view. He forgot his obligations as Verity's escort and as a member of Miss Pascoe's party. There were two or three carriages with footmen outside, and also a sedan chair. Lights from the bow windows of the houses in the square lit up the uneven cobbles and the trees of St. Mary's churchyard. He turned in that direction. Elizabeth's beauty struck him afresh. The fact that another man should be in full enjoyment of her was like the torture of damnation. To continue to flirt with a plain little pleasant schoolgirl was out of the question. As his hand closed about the cold railings under the trees, he fought to overcome his jealousy and pain, as one will overcome a fainting fit. This time, he must destroy it once and for all. Either he must do that, or leave the county again. He had his own life to live, his own way to go. There were other women in the world, common clay perhaps, but charming enough with their pretty ways and soft bodies. Either break his infatuation for Elizabeth, or remove himself to some part of the country where comparisons could not be made. A plain choice. He walked on, waving away a beggar who followed him with a tale of poverty and want. He found himself before the Bear Inn. He pushed open the door and went down the three steps into the crowded taproom, with its brass-bound barrels piled to the ceiling, and its low wooden tables and benches. This night being Easter Monday, the room was very full, and the flickering smoky light of the candles in their iron sconces did not at first show him where a seat was to be found. He took one in a corner and ordered some brandy. The potman touched his forelock and took down a clean glass in honour of his unexpected patron. Ross became aware that at his coming a silence had fallen. His suit and linen were conspicuous in this company of ragged, underfed drinkers.
"I'll have no more of such talk in here," said the bartender uneasily. "So you best get down off your perch, Jack Trip."
"I'll stay where I am," said a tall, thin man,
better dressed than most of the others, in a tattered suit sizes too big for him.
"Leave him stay," said a fat man in a chair below. "Even a crow's not denied his chimney pot."
There was a laugh, for the simile was apt enough. Conversation broke out again when it became clear that the newcomer was too deeply set in his own thoughts to spare time for other people's. His only sign of life was to motion to the tapster from time to time to refill his glass. Jack Tripp was allowed to stay on his perch.
"It is all very well to say, friend, but aren't we all men born of women? Does it alter our entry into the world or our exit out of it that we are a corn factor or a beggar? Talk of it being God's devising that some should wallow in riches and others starve is so much claptrappery. It is of man's devising, Marky. The devising of the rich merchants and sich like. To keep them where they be, and other folk in chains. 'Tis fine and pretty to talk religion and bribe the clergy with food and wine."
"Leave God alone," said a man from the back. "I've naught to say against God," croaked Jack Tripp.
but I don't hold with the God of the corn factor's choosing. Didn't Christ preach justice for all? Where's justice in starving women and children? The clergy are stuffed with food, while your women folk live on black bread and beech leaves, and your children shrivel and die. And there's corn in Penryn, friends.
There was a growl of assent. A voice spoke in Ross's ear.
Buy a drink for a lady, will you, my lord? Unlucky to drink alone. The devil gets in brandy when you sup alone.
He stared into the bold, dark eyes of a woman who had moved her position to sit beside him. She was tall, gaunt, about 24 or 25, dressed in a mannish blue riding suit, which had once been smart, but now was very shabby. It had perhaps been picked up at second or third hand. The stock was dirty, and the lace front awry. She had high cheekbones, a wide mouth, bright teeth, wide, bold, uncompromising eyes. Her black hair had been clumsily dyed copper. Indifferently, he motioned to the barman.
"Thanks, my lord," she said, stretching and yawning. "Here's to your health. You're looking wished. Down in the mouth, you know. Bit of company would do you no harm."
"Oi, there's corn in Penryn," said Jack Tripp hoarsely. "And who be it for? Not for the likes of we. Nay, sell the food abroad, that's the latest notion. They're not concerned with keeping us alive. Why is there no work in the mines? Because the tin and copper prices are so low. But why are they so low, friends? Because the merchants and the smelters fix the prices among themselves, to suit themselves. Let the tinners rot. Why should the merchants care? Same with the miller, same with all."
Ross shifted on his elbow. These taproom agitators. His audience liked to be talked to in this manner. It gave mouth to grievances they had hardly begun to form. The woman put her hand on his. He shook it off and finished his brandy.
"Lonely, my lord. That's what ails you. Let me read your palm."
She put out her hand again and turned his up to examine it.
"Yes. Yes. Being disappointed in love, that's what it is. A fair woman has been false to you. But there's a dark woman here. Look."
She pointed with a long forefinger.
"See? She's close to you. Right close to you. She'll give you comfort, me lord. Not like these dainty maids who are afraid of a pair of breeches. I like the looks of you, if you don't mind the expression. I'll wager you could give a woman satisfaction. But beware of some things. Beware of being over-particular yourself, lest these dainty maids betray you into thinking love's a parlour game. Love's no parlour game, me lord, as you very well know."
Ross ordered another drink.
"What? What of poor Betsy Pydar?"
Jack Tripp said, shouting to drown the talk which had broken out.
"What of that, I ask you, friends? What? You haven't heard of Widow Pydar? Hounded by the overseers and dying of starvation?"
The woman drained her glass at a draught, but she did not release his hand.
"I can see a snug little cottage by the river. I like the look of you, my lord. I feel an uncommon taking. I think you're the type of man who knows what's what. I've a talent for reading character, as you can see."
Ross stared at her, and she met his gaze boldly. Although they had only just set eyes on each other, it was as if a tremendous desire for him had flamed up in her. It wasn't all a matter of gold.
"And what did Parson Hal say when he was told?
asked Trip.
He said that Betsy Pydard brought this on herself by disobeying the laws of the country. That's your clergy for, eh?
Ross got up, pulled his hand away, put down a coin for the potman, and threaded his way towards the door. Outside, the night was very dark, and a light drizzle was falling. He stood for a moment, irresolute. As he turned away, he heard the woman slip out of the inn. She caught up with him quickly, and walked tall and strong by his side. Then she took his hand again. His impulse was to wrench it away and have done with her importuning. But at the last moment, his loneliness and dismay caught up with him, like a slow poisoning fog. What followed the rebuff? What was there for him to follow the rebuff? A return to the dance? He turned and went with her. Chapter 6. It was fortunate that Verity had arranged to spend the night with Joan Pascoe, for Ross saw no more of the ball. From the cottage of the woman Margaret, he rode straight home, reaching Nampara as the first threads of daylight were unpicking the clustered clouds of the night. This was Tuesday, the day of the Red Roof Fair. He stripped off his clothes, went down to the beach, and ran out into the surf. The cold, boisterous water washed away some of the miasmas of the night. It was biting, and tonic, and impersonal. As he left the water, the cliffs at the far end of the beach were losing their darkness, and the east sky had brightened to a brilliant cadmium yellow. He dried himself, and dressed, and woke Judd, and they had breakfast with the first sun slanting through the windows. They came to Red Roof just before 10, slid down the steep, greasy lane into the town, reached the chapel, crossed the river and climbed the other hill to the fields where the fair was being held. The business of the day was already in progress, with the buying and selling of livestock and farm and dairy produce. It took Ross some time to find what he wanted, for he had no money to throw about, and by the time the various purchases had been made, it was afternoon. In the second field, every tradesman in the district had put up a stall. The better class and larger tradesmen, with their saddlery and clothing and boots and shoes, clung to the upper part of the field. As the slope increased, one came to the gingerbread and sweetmeat stalls, the rope maker, the chair mender, the knife sharpener, the miscellaneous tents offering lanterns and brimstone matches, sealing wax and silver buckles, bracelets of braided hair, second-hand wigs and snuff boxes, bed mats and chamber pots. It would take Judd some hours to drive home the new oxen. So with time to spare, Ross wandered round to see all there was to be seen. From the third field, the substantial tradespeople were absent. This was the province of the professional rat-catchers, the peddlers, the halfpenny peep-shows. One corner of this field belonged to the apothecaries and the herbalists. Men squatted on the ground and shouted before ill-spelt notices advertising their wares, which were the latest and most infallible cures for all the diseases of the flesh. Pectoral drops, eau de charm, nervous drops, spirit of Benjamin, pomatum, fever powder, Jesuit drops. Here you could buy plantain and salad oil, angel water, hemlock for scrofulous tumours, and burdock burrs for scurvy. In the last field, which was the noisiest of all, were the sideshows and the hurdy-gurdies, the lily-banger stall where you cast dice for an Easter cake. In some sort of reaction from the bitterness and excesses of last night, he found a relief in mingling with his fellow men, in accepting the simplicity of their pleasures. He paid his halfpenny, and saw the fattest woman on earth, who, the man next to him was complaining, was not as fat as the one last year. For another halfpenny, she offered to take you behind a screen, and put your hand on a soft spot. but the man next to him said it was once bitten, twice shy, because all she did was put your hand on your own forehead. He stood for 15 minutes in a darkened booth, watching a company of guise players performing a mime about St. George and the dragon. He paid a halfpenny to see a man who in infancy had had his hands and feet eaten off by a pig, and who sketched quite amazingly with a chalk in his mouth. He paid another halfpenny to see a mad woman in a cage tormented by her audience. After he had seen the sights, he sat down at a drinking booth and sipped a glass of rum and water. The words of Jack Tripp, the agitator, came to him as he watched the people pass by. For the most part, they were weakly, stinking, rachitic, pockmarked, in rags, far less well found than the farm animals which were being bought and sold. Was it surprising that the upper classes looked on themselves as a race apart? Yet the signs he had seen of a new way of life in America made him impatient of these distinctions. Jack Tripp was right. All men were born in the same way. No privilege existed which was not of man's own contriving. He had chosen the last of the drinking booths at the extreme end of the ground. The noise and smell here was less overpowering. But just as he was ordering another drink, an uproar broke out behind the shop, and a number of people crowded to the corner to see what was going on. Some of them began to laugh. The uproar of squeals and barks went on. He rose to his feet and peered over the heads of the people standing near. Behind the gin booth was a clearing where earlier some sheep had been quartered. Now it was empty, except for a group of ragged boys watching a confused bundle of fur rolling over on the ground. This resolved itself into a cat and a dog, which the boys had tied tail to tail. The two animals were not much different in size. And, after a fight, during which neither had the advantage, they now wanted to part company. First the dog pulled and the cat sprawled, spitting. Then the cat with difficulty got to her feet, and with slow convulsive movements, digging her claws into the earth, dragged the dog backwards. The spectators roared with laughter. Ross smiled briefly, and was about to sit down when a smaller boy broke away from two others who were holding him and ran towards the animals. He dodged one of the other boys who tried to stop him and reached the creatures, knelt down, and tried to loosen the knotted twine about their tails, ignoring the scratches of the cat. When it was seen what he was about, there was a murmur from the crowd who perceived that they were to be robbed of a free entertainment. But this murmur was drowned in a howl of fury from the other boys, who at once rushed in and fell upon the spoil sport. He tried to put up a fight, but soon went under. Ross reached down for his drink, but remained on his feet while he sipped it. A big man, as tall as himself, moved up and partly obscured the view.
"Sakes alive!" said someone. "They'll mean the lad. A kicking of him like that. 'Tis past a joke, the young varmints." "And who's to say them nay?"
queried a little merchant, with a shade over one eye.
"They're wild as cats. 'Tis a disgrace to the town the way they roam." "Break your windows if you complain," said another. "And glad of the excuse, Aunt Mary Treglone. Her's got a cottage over to pool." "Oys, I know."
Ross finished his drink and ordered another. Then he changed his mind and moved into the crowd.
"God preserve us," said a housewife suddenly. "Is it a girl they're batting up? Or I'm mistook? And any of ye going to stop him?"
Ross took his riding crop from his boot and walked into the arena. Three of the urchins saw him coming. Two fled. But the third stood his ground with bared teeth. Ross hit him across the face with the whip, and the boy shrieked and fled. A stone flew through the air. There were three other boys, two sitting on the figure while the third kicked it in the back. This last youth did not see the approach of the enemy. Ross hit him on the side of the head and knocked him out. One of the others he lifted by the seat of his breeches and dropped into a neighbouring pool of water. The third fled and left the figure of the spoilsport lying on its face. The clothing was certainly that of a boy. A loose shirt and coat, trousers too big and falling loosely below the knee. A round black cap lay in the dust. The tousled hair seemed overlong. A stone hit Ross's shoulder. With the toe of his boot, he pushed the figure on its back. Might be a girl. The child was conscious, but too winded to speak. Every intake of breath was half a groan. A number of the townspeople had filtered into the clearing, but as the stones became more frequent, they sheered off again. "Have they hurt you, child?" Ross said. With a convulsive wriggle, she drew up her knees and pulled herself into a sitting position.
"Judas God!"
she was at last able to get out.
"Rot their dirty guts!"
The hail of stones was becoming more accurate, and two more struck his back. He put his whip away and picked her up. She was no weight at all. As he carried her towards the gin shop, he saw that crofters had joined together and were going after the boys with sticks. He set her down at the end of the trestle table he had recently left. Her head sank forward on the table. Now that the danger from missiles was over, people crowded round.
"What did they do to 'ee, my dear?"
"Scatting in the ribs, did they?"
"Sheen fair davered, poor maid." "I'd lace 'em."
He ordered two glasses of rum. "Give the child air," he said impatiently. "Who is she and what's her name?"
"Never seed she afore," said one. "She do come from Rosscare, I blay,"
said another.
"I know she,"
said a woman, peering.
"She'n Tom Carne's daughter. They do live over to a Luggin."
"Where is her father, then?"
"Down mine, I expect."
"Drink this." Ross put the glass against the girl's elbow, and she picked it up and gulped at it. She was a thin scarecrow of a child of 11 or 12. Her shirt was dirty and torn. The mop of dark hair hid her face. "Are you with someone?" Ross asked. "Where is your mother?"
"She ain't got one," said the woman, breathing stale gin over his shoulders. "Been in her grave these 6 year." "Wow, that isn't my fault," said the girl, finding her voice. "Nor never said 'twas," said the woman. "And what you doing in your brother's clothes, young Tom Rigg? You'll get the strap for this."
"Go away, woman," said Ross in irritation at being so much the focus of attention. "Go away, all of you. Have you nothing better to gape at?" He turned to the girl. "Is there no one with you? What were you about?" She sat up.
"Where's Garrick? They was tormenting him."
"Garrick?"
"My dog. Where's Garrick? Garrick! Garrick!" "Here he be."
A crofter pushed his way through the others.
"I got him for you. It was no easy job."
She got to her feet to receive a wriggling black bundle and collapsed on the seat again with it in her lap. She bent over the puppy to see if it was hurt, getting her hands more bloody than they were. Suddenly she looked up with a wail, eyes blazing amid the dirt and hair.
"Judas God! The dirty gnatlings! They've cut off his tail!"
"I done that," the crofter told her composedly. "Think I was going to get me hands tored for a mongrel cur? Besides, 'twas half off already, and he'll be better placed without it."
"Finish this," Ross said to the girl. "Then if you can talk, Tell me if you feel any bones broke in their handling." He gave the crofter sixpence, and the crowd, aware that the show was over, began to disperse, though for some time a ring of them remained at a respectful distance, interested in the gentleman. The dog was an emaciated mongrel puppy of a muddy black colour, with a long, thin neck, and covered sparsely about the head and body with short black curls. Its parentage was unimaginable. "Use this," said Ross, holding out his handkerchief. "Wipe your arms and see if the scratches go deep." She looked up from fingering her body and stared at the linen square doubtfully.
"'Twill foul it,"
she said. "So I can see."
"It mayn't wash out."
"Do as you're bid and don't argue." She used a corner of the kerchief on one bony elbow. "How did you come here?" he asked.
"Walked."
"With your father?"
"Father's down mine."
"You came alone?"
"With Garrick."
"You can't walk back like that. Have you friends here?"
"No."
She stopped suddenly in her perfunctory wiping.
"Judas, I feel some queer."
"Drink some more of this."
"No, 'tis that atop of nothing."
She got up and limped unsteadily to the corner of the gin shop. There, for the diversion and reward of the faithful spectators, she painfully lost the rum she had drunk. Then she fainted, so Ross lifted her back into the stall. When she recovered, he took her into the stall next door and gave her a square meal. The shirt she was wearing had old tears in it as well as new. The breeches were of faded brown corduroy. Her feet were bare, and she had lost the round cap. Her face was pinched and white, and her eyes, a very dark brown, were much too big for it. "What is your name?" he said.
"Demelza."
"Your Christian name, though."
"Please?"
"Your first name."
"Demelza."
"A strange name."
"Mother recalled it too."
"Demelza Khan, is that it?" She sighed and nodded, for she was well filled, and the dog under the table grunted with her. "I come from Nampara, beyond Saul. Do you know where that is?"
"Past St. Anne's."
"I am going home now, child. If you cannot walk, I'll take you first to Ilagan and leave you there." A shadow went across her eyes, and she did not speak. He paid what he owed, and sent word for his horse to be saddled. 10 minutes later, they were up and away. The girl sat silently astride in front of him. Garrick followed in desultory fashion, now and then dragging his seat in the dust, or peering suspiciously round to see what had become of the thing he had sometimes chased, and often wagged, but now could not locate. They cut across the moors by a mining track, worn deep and hard, and pitted by the passage of generations of mules. The countryside hereabout was entirely abandoned to the quest for minerals. All trees, except an occasional ragged pine, had been cut down for timber. Every stream was discoloured. Patches of cultivated land struggled among acres of mine refuse and mountains of stone. Engine sheds, wooden derricks, wheel stamps, windlasses, and horse gins were its adornment. Trenches and adits grew in the back gardens of the tiny cottages and huts. Potatoes were hoed, and goats grazed among the steam and the refuse. There was no town, scarcely even a hamlet, only a wide and sparse distribution of working people. It was the first time he had been to Ilagan this way. With the improvement in the pumping engine and the new loads of tin and copper available, Cornish mining had been going ahead until the slump of the last few years. People had migrated to these fortunate districts where the veins were richest and the home population had increased rapidly. Now, in the growing depression of the early 80s, many of the breadwinners were out of work, and the doubt arose as to whether the population could be maintained. The danger was not immediate, but the spectre was there. The girl in front of him gave a wriggle.
"Could he let me down here?"
she said.
"You're but halfway to a luggin' yet."
"I know. I doubt I should be going home yet a while."
"Why not?" There was no answer. "Does your father not know you've been out?"
"Yes. But I was lending my brother's shirt and breeches. Father says I must go to the fair whether or no. So he says I can borrow Luke's Sunday flibs."
"Well?"
"Well, I ain't got what I went for. And Luke's clothes is all slottery, so I reckon..."
"Why did you not go in your own clothes?"
"Father tore them last night when he give me a cootin'."
They jogged on for some distance. She turned and peered back to be sure Garrick was following.
"Does your father often beat you?" Ross asked.
"Only when he's been taking too much."
"How often is that?"
"Oh, maybe twice a week. Less when he ain't got the money."
There was silence. It was now late afternoon, and needed another 2 hours to dark. She began to fumble with the neck of her shirt and untie the string.
"You can see,"
she said.
"He used the strap last night. Pull my shirt back."
He did so, and it slipped off one shoulder. Her back was marked with weals. On some, the skin had been broken, and these were partly healed, with dirt smeared on them and lice at the edges. Ross pulled the shirt up again. "And tonight?"
"Oh, he'd give me a banger tonight, but I'll stay outdoors and not go home till he's below again."
They rode on. Ross was not oversensitive to the feelings of animals. It was not in his generation to be so. Though he seldom hit one himself, but wanton cruelty to children offended him. "How old are you?"
13, sir."
It was the first time she had sirred him. He might have known that these undersized, half-starved waifs were always older than they looked. "What work do you do?"
"Look after the house and planting tatties and feeding the pig."
"How many brothers and sisters do you have?"
6 brothers."
"All younger than you?"
"Asses."
She turned her head and whistled piercingly to Garrick. "Do you love your father?" She looked at him in surprise.
"Asses."
"Why?" She wriggled.
"'Cause it says you must in the Bible."
"You like living at home?"
"I runned away when I was 12.
"And what happened?"
"I was brought back."
Darkie swerved as a stoat scuttered across the path, and Ross took a firmer grip on the reins. "If you stay out of your father's way for a time, no doubt he'll forget what you've done wrong." She shook her head.
"He'll save an up."
"Then what's the use of avoiding him?" She smiled with an odd maturity.
"'Twill put an off."
They reached a break in the track. Ahead lay the way to Illagan. The right fork would bring him to Skirts and Anne's, whence he could join the usual lane to Saul. He reined up the mare.
"I'll get down here,"
she said. He said, "I need a girl to work at my house, at Nampara beyond St. Anne's. You would get your food and better clothing than you have now. As you are underage, I would pay your wages to your father." He added, "I want someone strong, for the work is hard." She was looking up at him with her eyes wide and a startled expression in them, as if he had suggested something wicked. Then the wind blew her hair over them, and she blinked. "The house is at Nampara," he said. "But perhaps you do not wish to come." She pushed her hair back, but said nothing. "Well then, get down," he continued with a sense of relief. "Or I will still take you into Illagan if you choose."
"To live at your house?"
she said.
Tonight? Yes, please.
The appeal, of course, was obvious. The immediate appeal of missing a thrashing. I want a kitchen maid, he said. One who can work and scrub and keep herself clean also. It would be by the year that I should hire you. You would be too far away to run home every week.
I don't want to go home ever, she said.
It will be necessary to see your father and get his consent. That may be hard to come by.
I'm a good scrubber, she said. I can scrub, sir.
Darkie was fidgeting at the continued check. We will go and see your father now. If he can be...
Not now. Take me with you. I can scrub. I'm a good scrubber.
There is a law to these things. I must hire you from your father.
Father don't come up from his core till an hour after cockshut. Then he'll go drink afore he do come home.
Ross wondered if the girl were lying. Impulse had prompted him this far. He needed extra help as much in the house as in the fields, and he disliked the idea of handing this child back to a drunken miner. But neither did he wish to cool his heels in some bug-ridden hovel until dark, with naked children crawling over him, then to be confronted by a gin-sodden bully who would refuse his suggestion. Did the child really want to come? About Garrick. I might not be able to keep Garrick. There was silence. Watching her closely, he could plainly see the struggle which was going on behind the thin, anemic features. She looked at the dog, then looked up at him, and her mouth gave a downward twist.
"Im and me's friends," she said.
"Well?" She did not speak for a time.
"Garrick and me's done everything together. I couldn't leave him to starve."
"Well?"
"I couldn't, mister, I couldn't."
In distress, she began to slip off the mare. He suddenly found that the thing he had set out to prove had proved something quite different. Human nature had outmaneuvered him. For if she would not desert a friend, neither could he. They overtook Judd soon after passing the gibbet at Bargus, where four roads and four parishes met. The oxen were tired of the long trek, and Judd was tired of driving them. He could not ride comfortably on blind Ramoth, because four large baskets crammed with live chickens were slung across the saddle. Also, he was deeply annoyed at having to leave the fair before he was drunk, a thing that had never happened to him since he was 10. He looked round sourly at the approach of another horse, and then pulled Ramoth off the track to let them pass. The oxen, being strung out in single file behind, followed suit quietly enough. Ross explained the presence of the urchin in three sentences and left Judd to work it out for himself. Judd raised his hairless eyebrows.
"'Tas all very well to play uppity snap with a lame horse,' he said in a grumbling voice. "'But picking up brats is another matter. Picking up brats is all wrong. Picking up brats will get thee in trouble with the law.'
"'A fine one you are to talk of the law,' Ross said. Judd had not been looking where he was going, and Ramoth stumbled in a rut. Judd said a wicked word.
"'Rot him! There he go again. How do you expect a man for to ride a blind horse? Pon my Sam, how do you expect for a horse to see where he's going when he can't see nothing? Tedn't in the nature of things. Tedn't horse nature.'
"'I've always found him very sure,' Ross said. "'Use your own eyes, man. He's uncommonly sensitive to the least touch. Don't force him to hurry, that's the secret.'
"'Force him to hurry? I should be forcing meself over his head into the nearest ditch if I forced him to go faster than a bullhorn leaving his slime twixt one stone and the next. Tedn't safe. One slip, one tumble, that's all.' "'Over you go, over his ears, fall on your nuddock, and fit, you're dead.'
Ross touched Darkie and they moved on.
A dirty bitch of a mongrel.
Judd's scandalized voice followed them as he caught sight of their escort.
Lord almighty, 'tas fit to duff you. We'll be adopting a blathering poorhouse next.
Garrick lifted a whiskery eye at him and trotted past. There had been talk concerning himself, he felt, at the Fork Roads, but the matter had been amicably settled. On one point, Ross was decided. There should be no qualifying of his position in the lice and bug battle. 6 months ago, the house, and particularly Prudy, had been alive with most of the things that crawl. He was not fussy, but he had put his foot down over Prudy's condition. Finally, the threat to hold her under the pump and give her a bath himself had had results, and today the house was almost free. And even Prudy herself, except for the homegrown colonies in her lank black hair. To bring the child into the house in her present state would knock the props away from the position he had taken up. Therefore, both she and the dog must be given a bath and fresh clothes found for her before she entered the house. For this duty, Prudy herself would be useful. They reached Nampara at sunset, a good half hour ahead of Judd, he reckoned, and Jim Carter came running out to take Darkie. The boy's health and physique had improved a lot during the winter. His dark Spanish eyes widened at the sight of the cargo his master brought. But in a manner refreshingly different from the painter's, he said no word and prepared to lead the horse away. The girl stared at him with eyes already wide with interest, then turned again and gazed at the house, at the valley and the apple trees and the stream, at the sunset, which was a single vermilion scar above the dark of the sea. "Where's Prudy?" said Ross. "Tell her I want her."
"She's not here, sir," said Jim Carter. "She left so soon as you left. She did say she was walking over to Marazanfo's to see her cousin."
Ross swore under his breath. The painters had a unique gift for not being there when wanted. "Leave Darkie," he said. "I'll attend to her. Judd is 2 miles away with some oxen I've bought. Go now and help him with them. If you hurry, you will meet him before he reaches the Melingy Ford." The boy dropped the reins, glanced again at the girl, then went off at a rapid walk up the valley. Ross stared a moment at the piece of flotsam he had brought home and hoped to salvage. She was standing there in her ragged shirt and 3/4-length breeches, her matted hair over her face and the dirty half-starved puppy at her feet. She stood with one toe turned in and both hands loosely behind her back, staring across at the library. He hardened his heart. Tomorrow would not do. "Come this way," he said. She followed him, and the dog followed her, to the back of the house, where between the still room and the first barn the pump was set. "Now," he said, "if you are to work with me, you must first be clean. Do you understand that?"
"Yes, sir."
"I cannot allow anyone dirty into the house. No one works for me if they are not clean and don't wash. So take off your clothing and stand under the pump. I will work the pump for you."
"Yes, sir."
She obediently began to untie the string at the neck of her shirt. This done, she stopped and looked slowly up at him. "And don't put those things on again," he said. "I'll find you something clean."
"Perhaps," she said, "I could work the handle myself."
"And stand under at the same time," he said brusquely. "Nonsense. And hurry, I've not all evening to waste over you." He went to the pump handle and gave it a preliminary jerk. She looked at him earnestly for a moment, then began to wriggle out of her shirt. This done, a faint pink tinge was visible under the dirt on her face. Then she slipped out of her breeches and jumped beneath the pump. He worked the handle with vigor. The first rinsing would not get rid of everything, but would at least be a beginning. it would leave his position uncompromised. She had an emaciated little body, on which womanhood had only just begun to fashion its design. As well as the marks of her thrashings, he could see blue bruises on her back and ribs where the boys had kicked her this afternoon. Fortunately, like her, they had been barefoot. She had never had such a washing before. She gasped and choked as the water poured in spurts and volumes upon her head, coursed over her body and ran away to the draining trough. Garrick yelped, but refused to move, so took a good deal of the water at second hand. At length, fearing he would drown her, he stopped, and while the stream of water thinned to a trickle, he went into the still room and picked up the first cloth he could find. "Dry yourself on this," he said. "I will fetch you something to put on." As he re-entered the house, he wondered what the something was to be. Prudy's things, even if they were clean enough, would smother the child like a tent. Jim Carter would have been the nearest choice for size, if he had owned any other clothes but those he was wearing. Ross went up to his own room and ransacked the drawers, cursing himself for never thinking more than one move ahead. One could not keep the child shivering there in the yard forever. Finally, he picked out a Holland shirt of his own, a girdle, and a short morning gown of his father's. When he went out, he found her trying to cover herself with the cloth he had given her, while her hair still lay in wet black streaks on her face and shoulders. He did not give her the things at once, but beckoned her to follow him into the kitchen, where there was a fire. Having just succeeded in shutting Garrick out of the house, he poked up the fire and told her to stand in front of it until she was dry and to put on the makeshift garments in what manner she chose. She blinked at him wetly, then looked away and nodded to show she understood. He went out again to unsaddle Darkie. Chapter 7. Demelza Khan spent the night in the great box bed where Joshua Poldark had passed the last few months of his life. There was no other room where she could immediately go. Later, she could be put in the bedroom between the linen cupboard and the painter's room, but at present, it was full of lumber. To her, who had slept all her life on straw, with sacks for covering, in a tiny crowded cottage, this room and this bed were of unthought luxury and unimagined size. The bed itself was almost as big as the room she and four brothers slept in. When Prudy, grumbling and flopping, showed her where she had to spend the night, she guessed that three or four other servants would come in later to share the bed. And when no one came, and it seemed she was to be left alone, a long time passed before she could bring herself to try it. She was not a child who looked far ahead, or reasoned deep. The ways of her life had given her no excuse to do either. With a cottage full of babies, she had had no time at all to sit and think, scarcely any even to work and think. And what was the good of looking for tomorrow, when today filled all your time and all your energy and sometimes all your fears? So that in this sudden turn in her fortunes, her instinct had been to accept it for what it was, and as long as it lasted, glad enough, but as philosophically as she had taken the fight at the fair. It was only this sudden luxury which scared her. The drenching under the pump had been unexpected, but its roughness and lack of concern for her feelings had run true to type. It fell in with her general experience. Had she then been given a couple of sacks and told to sleep in the stables, she would have obeyed and felt there was nothing amiss. But this development was too much like the stories old Meggie, the Sumpman's mother, used to tell her. It had some of the frightening, nightmare temper of those, and some of the glitter of her mother's fairy tales, in which everyone slept in satin sheets and ate off gold platters. Her imagination could gladly accept it in a story, but her knowledge of life could not accept it in reality. Her strange garments had been a beginning. They fitted nowhere and hung in ridiculous lavender-scented folds over her thin body. They were agreeable, but suspect. As this bedroom was agreeable, but suspect. When at length she found the courage to try